From the heartland of America and the gateway to the West, good morning, good evening, wherever you may be across the nation around the world. I'm George Norrie, and welcome to this most incredible program, Coast to Coast AM. Next hour, well, you haven't heard it all about 2012. David Wilcox joins us, and we'll talk with him about it. Now, before we get into some of the news of the day, as you know, for the past year, I've been talking about the ability to get disclosure from government officials, disclosure from someone high up about UFOs. I want you to listen to me. I want you to listen to me very closely right now, because in a moment, we are going to talk partially about this disclosure. But it's riveting. It's compelling. And finally, it's a story that we've been working on for a very, very long time. If you are at home, just sit quietly by your radio. If you are driving, though I don't want to recommend you stop doing what you're doing, you might soon want to pull over on the side of the road. Because if you've been a fan of Coast to Coast for so many years, tonight is a night that you may become vindicated. Tonight is a night you may finally stand up and cheer and say, "I told you so." So hold on. Now, his famously analytical mind worked out the laws of gravity and unraveled the motion of planets. But let's hope that this prediction, his prediction of the end of the world, doesn't come true. Sir Isaac Newton, he believed that the apocalypse would come in 2060, exactly 1,260 years after the foundation of the Holy Roman Empire, according to a recently published letter. It's an incredible story that we have posted now at coasttocoastam.com. The document reveals that Newton predicted the world will end in 2060. Luckily for modern scientists, in awe of his achievements, Newton based this figure on religion rather than reasoning. In a letter from 1704, which has gone on show now in Jerusalem's Hebrew University, Newton uses the Bible's Book of Daniel to calculate the date for the apocalypse. And he was right about one thing. He did say in his prophecy that the Jews would return to the Holy Land before the world ended. That's how he interpreted biblical prophecy. So he was right about that. Six scientists from some of the leading scientific institutions in the United States have issued what amounts to be an unambiguous warning to the world that civilization itself is threatened by global warming. They also implicitly criticized the UN's Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change for underestimating the scale of sea level rises that this century will have as a result of melting glaciers and polar ice sheets. These scientists say the sea levels are not going to rise by 40 centimeters by 2100. They will rise by several meters, and they say that is why the planet Earth is in imminent peril. In Charleston, South Carolina, say a prayer, 9 firefighters died in South Carolina fighting a blaze that swept through a furniture warehouse. They died doing what they loved and are heroes to the community that they helped save. That from the Charleston Fire Department chief. The firefighters died after the building's roof collapsed upon them. It was the worst death toll for firefighters since September 11, 2001, those terror attacks. In San Angelo, Texas, a man who doused himself with gasoline, then caught on fire after police tasered him, has died from his injuries. In Tokyo, an explosion at a boiler in a woman's spa has killed 3 people and injured at least 3 others. Methane gas appeared to have seeped from the ground beneath the popular hot spring and simply ignited. New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg is leaving the Republican Party and will remain unaffiliated with any political party. The move will clearly begin advancing rumors that the mayor is gearing towards a presidential run, which he has denied in the past. In a statement, however, the 65-year-old billionaire indicated this doesn't change his plans for any political future. He was a Democrat before he became a Republican, and now he's basically unaffiliated. You know, Ron Paul, the Texas congressman who is also running for president on the Republican side, has been trying to garner as much publicity as he can. And even though he seems to get the vote on the internet and the vote after these Republican debates, he's really ignored primarily by the mainstream media. Well, in an exclusive interview with me moments ago, Ron Paul talked about that. Congressman, it appears that you continue to win the Republican debates based on phone-in polls and internet polls, yet you seem to be getting ignored by the mainstream media and some other debate venues. Just your reaction to that.
Well, I think that's true, and I don't think they want me there to sort of point out some of the problems the Republican Party has been facing and the nation has been facing, because I think a lot of people don't want to hear about the truth of where the problems come from. So it doesn't surprise me a whole lot. A lot of people predicted that would happen. I'm pleased that we're doing so well outside the ordinary media. We're doing well, you know, on many of their talk shows like this, and the internet is going very well. So hopefully our persistence and our numbers will grow to the point where they'll have to cover our campaign.
Well, today, New York Mayor Michael Bloomberg has decided that he is not going to run as a Republican anymore, and he's kicking around a different party idea. Do you think the Republican Party is in serious shape right now?
Oh, I don't think there's any doubt about it, and I don't know whether they realize it or not, but they don't seem to want to change. I keep telling them they can't possibly win next year if they can, you know, continue to have the same policy as far as foreign policy goes in Iraq and the border situation. I think as long as they persist on that, there's no chance in the world that they can win. But even if you got a guy like Bloomberg that might get outside the Republican Party, if he doesn't change his positions, hopefully he won't be able to win either, because if he does, he has to fool the people, because I think it's the issues that really count. And right now, the people I talk to and hear from are sick and tired of what they're getting.
Well, when Fred Thompson can start leading in some of the Republican polls and truly not even have a major effort yet, that tells you that the American public, the American side that votes Republican, it seems to be very uneasy with most of the candidates who are out there today.
Yeah, I think that's both a good and bad thing. One is that they are disgusted, they're unhappy, and what they see they're not too pleased with. At the same time, they're willing to grasp at straws and grab anybody that comes along and hope that he'll do well. I mean, Giuliani's been leading the pack, but the more they get to know about him, the more they realize that he's not going to save the country either. So in some way, that's healthy, but I just hope they come our way in our direction where they can sort all the issues out and decide that we ought to have a different foreign policy and different domestic policy.
Well, it's still a long campaign. Are you happy with the invites you're getting to the debates?
I'm real pleased that I've been able to be in the debates, and even though we get less time, we get tremendous support immediately afterwards with new volunteers and new support and money coming in, so that's very good. It's still disappointing that hasn't translated into major media events, but we get a lot of other ones. You know, we've broken into some of these TV talk shows, sort of the comedy network, which quite frankly I wasn't really very much aware of, but there's a new constituency there, and they're responding very well, you know, so I'm very pleased with it. And what I'm most pleased about is the younger generation. You know, I'm just so excited that young people are very attracted to these ideas and realize that just going and getting to bed with big government isn't the answer to their problems. And I think financially they realize that they're bearing a great burden of the kind of programs we've had for these many, many decades, as well as the foreign policy, where we're not getting very far in that either.
Well, I tell you what's fascinating about you, Congressman, in your campaign is once people have an opportunity to hear you talk about the issues, to hear you talk in the debates, they like you. And that's important.
Yeah, I think that's a big step, and I'm always very pleased that, because I'm a very strong self-critic, and I always look at my flaws, but I keep saying, well, the message is powerful, and it's a message that I haven't by myself devised. You know, it's come a long time. It's this message, I think, what has made America great, and this message of limited government and the Constitution, and something that we all should rally around. So I'm very delighted that there is a lot of interest, and I give credit to the message.
All right, there you are. That's Texas Congressman Ron Paul, who wants to be the Republican presidential candidate. Vatican got road rage. The Vatican has issued 10 commandments for drivers, telling motorists to be charitable to others on the highway, to refrain from drinking and driving, to pray that you make it before you even buckle up, in a very unusual document from the Vatican's Office for Migrants and Itinerant People, also warning that automobiles can be an occasion of sin, particularly when used to make a dangerous overtaking maneuver or when used by prostitutes and their clients, they say. It warned about the effects of road rage, saying that driving can bring out primitive behavior in motorists, including impoliteness, rude gestures, cursing, blasphemy, loss of sense of responsibility, or deliberate infringement of the highway code. Very, very strange. The space shuttle Atlantis undocked from the International Space Station for its trip back to Earth, concluding a nearly 10-day stay that included construction work and a computer meltdown, expected to return at Cape Canaveral, Florida, on Thursday. In a moment, we'll be talking with the publisher of UFO Magazine, William Burns. An incredible story is about to hit you. Don't go away. Now, a moment I've been waiting for a very, very long time. Bill Burns is a New York Times best-selling author. He wrote the book The Day After Roswell with the Colonel Philip Corso, the late Colonel Corso, and also co-authored with me my book, Worker in the Light. And he's a publisher of UFO Magazine, and I donate my time to that magazine every month and I write a column to them because I just want his audience to be able to experience who we are here at Coast to Coast, and it's been a good marriage between the two of us. Bill has a story that he's going to break with us tonight that will appear in 2 weeks in UFO Magazine and is also partly in the book Witness to Roswell, which will come out, written by Carrie and Schmidt. And I do want to say this about Bill Burns, first of all, because it's important, that if Bill Burns told me frogs were falling from the sky, I would believe him, though I would go outside to make sure. And he's with us tonight. Hey, Bill, thanks for coming on the program.
Hi, George, and thanks for the column for this month, because this is a blockbuster. I mean, rarely do you get that kind of tingle, that absolute, it's beyond excitement when you see something through somebody else's eyes. And in this issue and in Don's and Tom Carey's book, Don Schmidt's book, you are going to see something that when you finish reading it, when you finish hearing the words that we're going to hear tonight, any doubts that you had, not only about Roswell and what happened there, but doubts about UFO and extraterrestrial contact will go away. Basically, all you skeptics, get out of the pool, because the person who's going to talk from the grave tonight is the person who will dispel all doubts. It's in your column in the July issue, and it's the statement by Lieutenant Walter Hout, the military officer who is at the center 60 years ago of the disclosure, the first disclosure. There was no cover-up 60 years ago. That's the way the story went until tonight, and you'll hear basically what Walter Hout said about it, and it is mind-boggling.
Walter is no longer with us. He is passed on. He was the public information officer who wrote the initial press release that was then published by I don't know how many newspapers picked it up, but I do know it was a headline in Roswell.
Yes, it was published in the West Coast.
That said that they had a captured flying saucer. He wrote that press release, and then he was told to recant it, right?
That's correct. What happened was the original story, which now changes, the original story was that Colonel Blanchard, who was the commandant, commanding officer of the 509th in Roswell, Walker Field, the Roswell Army Airfield, Blanchard said to Walter Hout, as Walter Hout told me, told Stanton Friedman, told Don Schmidt, told Kevin Randall, told us all. The colonel just told me, we picked up a flying saucer north of Roswell. I want you to write this up, Walter. I want you to get it to all the newspapers. And that's what Walter did. And then the next day, Roger Ramey at Fort Worth basically said it was a weather balloon, so the story changed.
Go ahead, Bill.
Was it a UFO? And he says, well, you know, that's what Blanchard said, it was UFO, and I have a reason to believe it. And it stopped there, and all he did was smile.
And it stopped there for so many years until his death. And then after that, we find out what, Bill?
Here's what we find out. That over the years, Walter Hout basically said only what I just said tonight in that press release. And then in 2002, partly after a discussion with Don Schmidt, which Don told me this afternoon, his interview is in the July issue, they were talking about this. And Walter Hout gradually, as the years went on, now remember, he's the man, George, who started the Roswell Museum, okay?
Yeah, so he decided to stay and live in Roswell, New Mexico, which is where I'm going on July 6th, by the way.
Indeed. And he decided to stay and live in Roswell after he left the military, after he was transferred, he was basically translated as an officer from the reserves to regular military, which meant a whole new career path opened up for him. And since Colonel Blanchard ultimately became General Blanchard, the Air Force Chief of Staff, and here was Walter Hout, basically a man. These two were bonded. They were joined at the hip. He was his aide. He would have been his aide had he been a general, but he was his aide. And he would have gone all the way to the Pentagon with him. And since you know what it's like at the Pentagon, you know what Walter Hout's career would have been like had he stayed in the Air Force and probably would have gotten his star. He probably would have been a brigadier. That's what he gave up to stay in Roswell, a man from Chicago, a big city guy, to live out his life in the small city of Roswell, insurance salesman, and he founded the Roswell Museum, and he always walked around with that little Cheshire Cat smile. Why?
And the why, of course, as we'll talk about in just a moment after the break, Bill, had to do with this. Many are listening right now saying, all right, give us the blockbuster disclosure story you just told us about. What is it? Many will think, well, what was it? A deathbed confession? Did he, Walter Hout, tell somebody a story that has been passed on and has now been put down in book form? No, it's much more than that. Walter Hout, Bill, signed a document, didn't he?
Yes, sir, he did. Walter Hout, in 2002... swore out an affidavit. It was notarized, and he ordered it sealed until his death, and he died last year. In that affidavit, Walter Hout will tell you the most incredible story about Roswell, and a man who was so honorable in his presence. I mean, you've met him, we've all met. In his presence, you know how honorable and credible and truthful this man is. You will hear a story of not just the Roswell event, the true Roswell event for the first time, but you will hear the story of a man who waited for 60 years so that this story could be told after his death. You'll finally hear the real story of Jesse Marcel and what happened in that crash in July 60 years ago.
You know, Bill, Jesse Marcel Jr., the son of, will be our guest on Thursday talking about the Roswell legacy. And this is incredible timing because so many people out there have been told the story of Roswell, and it has just fallen on deaf ears. I hope to God that our dear friend Stanton Friedman is listening tonight at what you're about to tell us, that what Lieutenant Walter Hout put in that affidavit, what he saw, what he was told, what he felt, because this was coming from the military officer who was there. This isn't some government story that has been sent out to try to lead everybody in a different direction.
No, it's not. And after tonight, and I know all of us in ufology in the field will do this, it's going to be that. We challenge the Air Force. We say, Air Force, you've come up with how many different cover stories for this? Now come up with a cover story to challenge, to refute what your own officer who revealed the truth 60 years ago, what he's now saying really happened.
When we come back, We will have Bill Burns disclose to us what Walter Hout said in his affidavit. Get ready for this. And then a little bit later on, I'm going to open up the phone lines. You might have a question or two for Bill Burns. But first, we're going to get the story when we come right back. And now what we're going to do is talk about Lieutenant Walter Hout and what he signed, what he witnessed back 60 years ago in Roswell, New Mexico. And then we will take phone calls with Bill Burns. The complete story will be written in my column in UFO Magazine in a couple weeks. And the very in-depth story, of course, will be in the book Witness to Roswell. Bill, very briefly, tell us the story that we've all heard about with regards to Roswell.
Here's the story we've all heard, that Walter Hout said, and you could find the story in all back issues of our magazine and other books, that Walter Hout got a phone call. He was aware of activity going on outside of Roswell, north of the town. There was a crash of something. He didn't know what. Gets a phone call from Blanchard, Colonel Blanchard, commanding officer of the 509th at Walker Field in Roswell, and says, Walter, I want you to write this press release, and I want you to get it out to all the newspapers and the radio station, and I want the press release to say that, look, the Army's picked up a flying saucer outside of Roswell.
Not a balloon, not a plane, but a flying saucer.
Blanchard's words, the Army's picked up a flying saucer, and of course, flying disc was all over the west coast. Stanton tells the story very well, that it's over the west coast of the country, and the East Coast newspapers, it was late in the day, so the East Coast newspapers hadn't gotten the story yet. By the time the East Coast newspapers got the story the next day, the Army Air Force had already denied the story and said it was a weather balloon, but on the West Coast you had 2 days of news, and Walter Hout said that his phone rang off the wall, and he basically took off and left the base to let the phone ring. And that's the original story. It was really only a two-line story, and that was the end of it. That was the original story.
And then we've got the infamous picture, of course, of was General Ramey, right, kneeling over all the wreckage of what they claim to be a balloon or something?
Right. At Fort Worth, they took a picture of, you had a picture of Ramey, you had a picture of Major Jesse Marcel, the base intelligence officer, over the wreckage of a balloon. And the Army basically empties the saucer story by saying it was really only a weather balloon. And how humiliating do you think that was? This is a vindication, by the way, for Jesse Marcel and Jesse Marcel Jr. at the same time. How humiliating do you think it must have been for the base intelligence officer of the 509th, a strategic air command unit, right? This was an atomic unit, to stand over a weather balloon and have to admit, oh, gee, I made a fundamental mistake. I can't tell what a weather balloon is. Imagine that humiliation in 1947.
And what we didn't know at the time was that Walter Hout had seen the real wreckage.
Now,
he inspected
also
that.
Yes, Walter Hout had seen the real wreckage, George, you're right. And just as important, Jesse Marcel had seen the real wreckage. And even more important, there had been a strategy meeting before that famous news release was created. So, Walter Hout begins. Now, this is a guy who basically, 2002, sets down these words. So he begins, it's basically a regular format of an affidavit. I'm Walter Hout. The date is December 26, 2002. It's sworn before a witness, and his signature is notarized by a local notary public. And he says what his name is. I was born June 2nd, 1922, et cetera, et cetera. I'm retired in 1947. He was the PIO at the Roswell Army Air Base, at Walker Field. And then he begins that he was aware that someone had reported the remains of a downed vehicle in mid-morning on Monday, July 7th, after he came back from that July 4th weekend. And he was also aware, he says, that by late afternoon of that same day, he was learning that there were additional reports. So in other words, the story begins to grow from the civilian sector, not the army sector, but the civilian sector. And we find out why, of course, in the entire story, that people were crawling over this place where somehow, some way, this vehicle had been downed. The next morning, hear these words. The next morning, it's July 8th, and he walks into the regular Roswell staff meeting, right? The Roswell Army Airfield staff meeting. Nothing unusual, right? It's 7:30 in the morning. And he looks around the room and he says, besides Blanchard, the commanding officer, and Marcel, there's CIC Captain Sheridan Cavett. And, of course, we know that Cavett, with Marcel, went to the ranch with Brazel to find the debris. So then there's Patrick Saunders, Colonel John Hopkins, the operations officer. He lists the names of the people that were there. Major Isidore Brown, the personnel officer, Ulysses S. Nero, the supply officer. Here's the bombshell. And from Carswell Army Air Force Base in Fort Worth, Texas, Blanchard's boss, Brigadier General Roger Ramey, and his chief of staff, Colonel Thomas J. DuBose, were also in attendance. Get this. They didn't fly to Fort Worth to show Ramey the material for the first time. Ramey and DuBose came to Roswell on July 8th. They were there in the office with Marcel having a staff meeting. What was the main topic of discussion? As reported by Marcel and Cavett, it was the extensive debris field in Lincoln County, approximately 73 miles northwest of Roswell. A preliminary briefing was provided by Blanchard about, get this, a second site approximately 40 miles north of town. Not one, but two. So all the years were now vindicated. There were two sites. Here comes the bombshell again. Samples of wreckage were passed around the table. Okay? So that everybody in that room, Blanchard and Hout and Ramey and DuBose and Cavett and Marcel all sat as samples of the wreckage were passed around the table. It was, and here's what Hout says, it was unlike any material I had or have ever seen in my life. Pieces which resembled metal foil paper, thin yet extremely strong, and pieces with unusual markings along their length. Here's Jesse Marcel's junior story, absolutely proven, were handed from man to man,
I'm getting chills, Bill.
Their opinion, no one was able to identify the crash debris. There you go.
Whatever crashed there was obliterated. However, there's another bombshell.
That's right.
The bodies.
Here it comes. One of the main concerns was whether we should go public with the discovery. General Ramey proposed a plan, which I believe originated with his bosses in the Pentagon. Attention needed to be diverted from the more important site north of town by acknowledging the other location north of town because too many civilians were already there. So here in paragraph 9, Hout describes the cover story everybody came up with at the table to divert attention. Then, after the meeting, Blanchard phones me, and he dictates the press release that I'm supposed to give to the newspapers and radio stations KGFL and KSWS. And then, you ready? Before leaving the base, Blanchard suggests that Hout go to Hangar Building 84, a B-29 hangar located on the east side of the tarmac. Now, here's where the other witnesses now get vindicated. Upon first approaching the building, I observed that it was under heavy guard, both inside and outside. Don Schmidt and Tom Carey explained to me this morning that these were soldiers that came from other units as well, so already the Army was compartmentalizing who'd have access to the story. Okay? Now, once inside, I was permitted from a safe distance to observe the object just recovered from north of town. And here it is. Oh. It was approximately 12 to 15 feet in length, not quite as wide as 6 feet, and more of an egg shape. Now, if you remember the story from the witnesses of this object being flatbedded through town,
right.
They didn't talk about a delta. They talked about an egg-shaped object under a tarpaulin. And here is the confirmation of that. Lighting was poor, but its surface did appear metallic. No windows, no portholes, no wings, no tail section, no landing gear. Then finally, here it comes. Also from a distance, Hout writes in paragraph 13, I was able to see a couple of bodies under a canvas tarpaulin. Only the heads extended beyond the covering, and I was not able to make out any features, but the heads did appear larger than normal, and the contour of the canvas over the bodies suggested the size of a 10-year-old child. And at a later date, he says that Blanchard, in his office, stood there and held his hand up 4 feet high and said that was the size of these creatures.
Oh, my gosh. Stay with us. We'll take your calls with Bill Burns next on Coast to Coast AM. And what's so remarkable about all this, Bill, is the fact that it also corroborates what Colonel Corso told you.
That's right. I mean, Corso told me basically the same story that he said he saw. He saw it Fort Riley, Kansas, and of course he'd heard from other people, and what he heard from the medical examiners at Walter Reed Army Hospital, who said they had one of the bodies that they were performing an autopsy on. So, I mean, but this confirms Frankie Rowe, who talked about this metallic cloth that she squeezed and popped out. It confirms Jesse Marcel Sr., who was actually there. Imagine how humiliated he was to be sitting at a table, know the truth, and then have to sit and wait for 30 years, and finally he just couldn't hold it anymore, and he told the truth, and he interviewed with Stanton. It confirms Jesse Marcel Jr., who you're going to talk to this week, and who had to carry this story knowing the truth for all those years after his father went public, and actually he saw the same I-beam that Walter
yes.
Hout is talking about in the memo and of course in the affidavit. And of course it confirms Walter Hout and confirms all the witnesses. Alpha Boyd's father, who was standing by the corner of Hangar 84. We have the story in an old issue of UFO magazine, The Children of Roswell. Alpha Boyd's father is standing by. He went out for a smoke outside Hangar 84. Suddenly they brought this alien on a stretcher. This creature looks at Alpha Boyd's father, communicates that it's dying, and they rush it into the hangar, and then officers that Boyd's father had never seen before rough him up. They brace him, and it took a captain from who knew him to yank him out of that mess and say, look, this guy's a straight-up guy. He's not going to talk.
I mean,
it confirms George Wilcox, his wife Inez Wilcox, and the diary she wrote describing when Brazel brought this material into the jail.
The description by Hout also is exactly like those little aliens right at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind, when they kind of took the American astronauts, I guess, or travelers, into the craft. You know how they all fluttered around them?
They took Richard Dreyfuss by the hand, and they walked him into the craft. Indeed, it also confirms, I'll tell you, this is the dead-on confirmation of Lieutenant Colonel Black Mac Magruder, Marion Magruder, the Marine pilot, who was part of the National Air War College class of 1948, who in July 1947 went to Wright Field, by the way, with his class because the Army had not yet made a decision about what to do, and he saw the live alien. We have this in a back issue as well. He saw the live alien, and he describes it exactly the way Walter Hout describes it and exactly the way Alpha Boyd's father described it. Three eyewitnesses describing the same creature.
Without the affidavit, it would still be a gangbuster story, Bill, but with it, it just adds so much to the credibility. Let's take some final calls here. East of the Rockies, you're on the air with us on Coast to Coast. Hi there.
How you doing?
Good.
I'm being from Augusta, Georgia.
Hi.
My mom was born in 47 on July 7th, and she passed away last year on July 8th. That was just kind of a weird situation. I drive a tow truck on the weekends, and I picked up a guy, and he said he was from California. He was in the service. I picked him up, and as we was going down the road, he said he'd never been to Georgia, but he wanted to go to this local fort that we have and be dropped off there. And then we got to talking about different things, and my mom was in the car, and she brought up the situation of an alien, you know, alien encounters that she's, you know, seen or had, and she never really come public with them. Well, he just started rattling off about Operation Green Light, Blue Light, Operation, I don't know what it was, what he was talking about, and it scared us so bad we actually pulled over, called 911, the police came, he had some warrants out of California.
He never
got his pickup truck. He never heard from him. I don't even know what, it scared us to death, and we never even told anybody about it. We just said that the truck was impounded, and it's sitting in the storage lot for years and years.
That's a strange story. I don't know about that. I mean, he didn't threaten you or anything. It was just his story that scared you.
No, he rattled off, and he started talking so fast and almost in a different language. And he said something about microchips inside. They put this inside. And he said he's never been to Georgia, but he wanted to go to Fort Gordon. He wanted to see a certain colonel. He wanted to go now and just, you know, I don't know. It really scared us, you know.
Bill, what do you think?
Wow. You know, it just tells you, look, if you know about UFOs, don't talk about them to strangers because you're going to wind up in the
asylum. They'll take you away or jail. West of the Rockies, you're on with us. Hi there.
Hello. Hey, guys, great show. Very interesting. I've always been very interested in the UFO phenomenon since I was a young kid. But I read my favorite authors in the field, John Keel and Jacques Vallée.
Sure.
And these guys eventually come to the conclusion that the UFO assumption that it's extraterrestrial may be an assumption, and it may be something that this phenomenon wants people to think it is, and it may not be what it is supposed to. You know, it may be like a Trojan horse, as John Keel calls it, Jacques Vallée calls them the cosmic jokers. That affidavit is unbelievable. That's amazing.
Oh, absolutely. And Jacques Vallée, if I recall, Bill, from reading a lot of the work that UFO Magazine has published about the individual, basically he believes in messengers of deception. He believes that what's happening now are dimensional beings or entities. Am I correct?
Yes, that's exactly right. He believes that we're not talking about people from a different star system per se, but actually from a different dimension. And one of the things that Vallée said to Peter Sturrock, who chaired the Rockefeller Commission on the study of UFOs, was that UFOs were so prevalent around our planet that astronomers would actually get angry at the UFOs in the way between them and the star they were looking at.
What we don't know about the situation at Roswell is whether these were extraterrestrial, whether they came from a hollow Earth, whether they came from another dimension. We don't know this, right?
We don't. The only clue that I had was from this naval officer. He was from the Office of Naval Intelligence, ONI, called George Hoover. We've talked about him before, who said that he was the Corso of the Navy and that the military believed, and he said he knew, that these entities were not so much interplanetary, but they were literally time travelers. And the big secret is that they were us from the future, and that we and they had the same powers, and that was the real fear of the government, that we had the ability to manipulate reality around us. We've always had that ability. We just didn't know how to use it. And if we ever learned how to use it, and we're not ready for it, we would cause chaos. And that was the big secret that the Navy eventually found out.
Bill Burns, one incredible story, one that we've been waiting for a long time. And maybe, just maybe, Bill, this will be the beginning of more disclosure. What do you think?
If I were Peter Gersten, Stephen Bassett, Stephen Greer, if I were they, I would be at this moment in time getting my FOIA letters ready, because here's a legal document, an affidavit, that you could drop on the desk of the Air Force Chief of Staff and say, the records are there, here's an affidavit from one of your officers, this
explain
describes the
it.
Truth,
yep.
Disclose the record.
You got it right. Bill, thanks so much. Bill Burns, publisher of UFO Magazine. I'm George Norrie, and Coast to Coast continues in a moment.